Okay, well, we're moving right along. We're in Genesis chapter 22, and again, Genesis chapter 2 is one of those key chapters, you know, a lot of key verses and chapters, but Genesis 22 is one of those where God tested Abraham and, you know, a divine examination of his faith and obedience and used this test to grow him in his sanctification and his relationship with the Lord. As we get to chapter 22, there's been about 20 years of silence since chapter 21, since he had that covenant with Abimelech. So, you know, kind of quiet, still no land. Yeah, he's got Isaac now, but, you know, things, the promises, how are those going along? About a 20-year wait. You know, just get up into your hundreds, 20 years is a long time. So, and then in chapter 22, then he comes back on the scene. And then on into chapter 23, we have the Lord appearing again to Abraham. So in chapter 22, he in the test, he tells Abraham to take his son Isaac, his beloved son, the long-awaited child of promise, and offer him as a burnt offering on a mountain in the region of Moriah. So, you know, I'd probably be saying, did I hear you right? Is that really what you're saying? But Abraham immediately obeys. Again, remember, he has the privilege of talking directly with God. Okay, we go through God's word and the Spirit giving us convictions on things to do. He had direct communication from God. No question, obeys without protest, gets up early the next morning, takes a three-day journey to Moriah. When he sees the site where he's going to offer the sacrifice has been revealed to him by God. He tells the two servants that are with him, you know, you wait here while Isaac and I go forward, and then we will both return in verse 5. So we get the first hint there in verse 5 of chapter 22 that Abraham knows that the death of Isaac is not the end of the story. Okay, he knows he's fully intends on sacrificing Isaac, but then from Hebrews, we know that his thinking was, you know, I'll sacrifice Isaac in obedience to God, but then God's going to raise him from the dead. So that was kind of the thinking that Abraham had at the time. There was a question last week about carrying the fire in verse 6. So Abraham and Isaac are going up to do the offering, and it talks about carrying the fire and how that might happen. And of course, they didn't have matches or, you know, a flame thing. So usually what they do is they take like a clay pot and put some burning embers in it. And then that would be safe so you could travel. And then it'd be easy to light some brush when you got to where you needed to go. So you could light a fire quickly rather than sitting there trying to make sparks and light things. So that would typically be how that would have been handled back in the day. So again, portable enough to hold while walking and safe enough to transport over a long journey. So as they climb the mountain together, Isaac notices that there's fire and wood, but no animal. So again, he asks his father in verse 8, you know, where's the animal for the offering? And in verse 8, Abraham replies with confidence, God will provide himself the lamb for the burnt offering. So again, we see Abraham's faith and Isaac's implicit trust in his father. And we know that Isaac was probably 20-ish or so. Again, we're not absolutely sure where it was, but probably a young man. By this time, he could have certainly resisted, you know, his dad's tying him up and laying him on the altar on the wood. It's like my sons would have all resisted, I'm afraid to say. But, you know, this implicit trust that Isaac had in his dad, you know, no further questions, no required explanation. So, again, they reach the site, and Abraham's ready to plunge the knife. In verse 11, and the angel of the Lord, again, calls out, the pre-incarnate Christ calls out from heaven and stops Abraham from carrying through. And then he goes on to commend Abraham's faith. You know, Abraham has demonstrated his fear and reverence for God by offering his only son in the sense of son of the line of promise. And then Abraham looks, and there's a ram caught in the thicket there, and that ram's not as lucky as Isaac. That ram is taken and sacrificed. And then in verse 14, Abraham names that site, Yahweh will provide. We talked about how the Hebrew there is Yahweh Yireh, which is also Jehovah Jireh. A little bit different pronunciation there. but the idea that God will provide. So again, serves as an ongoing memorial, the name does, to the Mount of Moriah, where God provided a substitute sacrifice to die in the place of Isaac, Abraham's son. So then we talked a little bit about, and just review it kind of superficially here, but this event with Isaac, this sacrifice of Isaac, or near sacrifice of Isaac, pictures is a foreshadowing of future events with Jesus. And it's pretty obvious as you're reading through this, there's parallels. And then the New Testament says very clearly that there are parallels, intended parallels here. So again, the similarities between Isaac and the sacrificial death of Jesus some 2,000 years later. So again, we have a beloved son, both Isaac and Jesus. You know, the first time agape is used in the New Testament is in Matthew chapter 3, and you know, where God says, "My beloved son." And then in Genesis, the first time that the word love is used is in Genesis chapter 22, verse 2, where we see the love that Abraham has for Isaac. So there's a beloved son, and there's a miraculous birth. Remember, Isaac was born when Sarah was beyond the years of conception. And of course, Jesus was born of a virgin. And then the father offers the son. So Abraham obediently obeys God when God commanded him to offer Isaac. And then in Romans chapter 8, verse 32, for Jesus, God did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. So we've got there's a beloved son, there's a miraculous birth, there's the father offering the son. And then there's a willing son, Isaac and Jesus both willingly going to the sacrifice. The place of sacrifice, Mount Moriah, would be the general vicinity of Jerusalem. And then the resurrection imagery. Isaac isn't literally resurrected, but in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 19, we looked at this last week, but he, Abraham, considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he also received Isaac back. So there's a figurative resurrection there. The idea is that when Abraham untied Isaac and got him down off the altar, it was just like he had been raised from the dead, of course, and then Jesus literally being resurrected from the dead. So after the sacrifice, God reaffirmed his covenant promises to Abraham in verse 15 through 19 of chapter 22. And verse 16, he swears by himself, you know, "I swear by God." Well, God, you know, that's what we would do. God can only swear by himself because there's nobody greater. So he swears by himself that he will bless Abraham abundantly, his descendants and his territory, and the worldwide blessing that will come through Abraham and his descendants. And then this particular passage concluded with Abraham and Isaac returning to the two waiting servants. Again, just like Abraham had told them back in verse 5, you know, "We will both return." So they go back to where the servants are waiting, and they head back back home to Beersheba, which is where they were living at the time. Okay, so that's where we left off then last week in verse 19 of chapter 22. So then today we'll pick up in verse 20 of chapter 22, close out the chapter. And it closes out with a short genealogy for Abraham's brother Nahor. That's what we have in the first four verses. And again, really here, the focus is this is a family background for Isaac's future wife, Rebekah. And verse 20. "Now it happened after these things that it was told to Abraham, saying, 'Behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz his firstborn, and Buz his brother, and Kemuel the father of Aram, and Kesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. And Bethuel was the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother.'" Okay, so again, Abraham had two brothers. You know, back in Genesis 11, we looked at some of the genealogy there. But Abraham had two brothers, Nahor and Haran. And, you know, their father was Terah. Remember that Terah's father was Nahor. So we had Nahor, Terah, Abraham, then Abraham and his brothers, Nahor and Haran. So the grandson is named after the grandfather, so don't get the Nahors confused here. And then Nahor marries his niece Milcah, okay, the daughter of Haran and the sister of Lot. So the interconnections there. We'll go through I did hand out a genealogy chart a while back. We won't go through that here because really the focus here isn't on Nahor's genealogy. It's more on Rebecca's coming along. So we'll look at the genealogies a little closer in the future. But so again, Nahor married his niece Milcah, and then she has eight sons, and we won't go through all those eight again, since it's kind of a nightmare trying to figure out how to say them all in a reasonable way. But really, none of these men and none of these eight sons that Milcah bore to Nahor are found anywhere else in the Bible. There's, in some places, there's other people with the same name, but they're not connected. So, you know, lots of times we'll name people in our genealogy, and there's the same name in another genealogy, but we're not connected. So sharing of names is common in our day, as well as in this day. Bethuel, in verse 22, is really the focus here. He's the most significant to the patriarchal story, and he's the father of Rebekah. And Rebekah, of course, will marry Isaac in Genesis chapter 4. So that Genesis chapter 24. So again, that's the line of promise. You know, interestingly enough, Bethuel also fathered Laban, who will be the father of Leah and Rachel, future wives of Jacob, the son of Isaac and Rebekah. So again, we'll talk about those interconnections when we get to those sections. Then verse 24, and Nahor's concubine, and his concubine, whose name was Rumah, also bore Teba and Gaham and Tahash and Maaka to him. So four more sons by, four more sons of Nahor by his concubine, Rumah. And again, these really aren't mentioned anywhere else. Interesting enough, that name Maaka, there are eight other individuals in the Old Testament that are named Maaka, but not this Maaka. And one of them is kind of ringing a bell. One of David's wives and the mother of Absalom was Maaka. So again, that's hundreds of years later. Again, so these individuals really, for the most part, have been lost to history. But the naming of all these individuals, and we've talked about this before, I think one thing it really points out is we're dealing with real history. You know, these were individuals that lived. Otherwise, why even mention them? I would just leave them out if this is, you know, fantasy or whatever. But we're dealing with real history and real individuals in that history. A couple of things on, you know, the genetically close marriages, and we've talked about this before, were necessary and not forbidden until the Mosaic Law. I mean, Adam and Eve's sons, where did they find their wives? It was obviously their sisters. So, you know, that kind of thing sounds pretty gross to us in this day and age, but there obviously had to be close genetic marriages when the human race started out. And so that carries on. So we still have intermarriages, you know, uncles and nieces and nephews and aunts and cousins and all that is still going on in the days of the patriarchs. And again, that isn't really dealt with on a legal basis until we get into Leviticus. Polygamy is a little different story, okay? Genetically close marriages, all fine and proper and okay. But polygamy is a different story. If you remember, we talked a little bit about polygamy back in Genesis chapter 4. Who was the first polygamist? It was wicked Lamech, the son of Cain. So that's the example you're following with polygamy. And, you know, the patriarchs do practice some polygamy, and they have concubines. They have multiple wives. But the end result of polygamous relationships, and we'll see that as we walk through things, well, we've already seen it with Sarah and Hagar. You know, it's jealousy and rivalry and turmoil and tension is always the result. And the Old Testament never explicitly condemns polygamy. But Genesis is kind of a case study showing why polygamy leads to trouble. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17, talking about the kings, the command is that the king should not multiply wives to himself. So there's that in there. But other than that, polygamy is allowed but not endorsed, and it's certainly not the standard. You know, you contrast that with the monogamous ideal of Genesis chapter 2. You know, verse 24 of chapter 2, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wives. No. His concubines. No. Singular. Wife. Shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Again, the language is singular and intimate, and that verse is quoted at least four times in the New Testament. So that's the standard. The Bible doesn't come out and say, you shall not marry a second wife. Okay, that's not a command that's in there clear. But the understanding is very clear that that's the standard. The standard is monogamy. One man, one woman, united eternally in a relationship of love. Okay, so again, genetically close marriages, all fine and proper and necessary. Polygamy, a terrible distortion of God's plan. Okay, now verse 23, we'll have the death and burial of Sarah. So verse 1, and Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So we're 62 years after they'd entered the land of Canaan back in chapter 12. So Abraham would be 137 years here, and Isaac would be about 37 years old probably when Sarah died at the age of 127. And really, the emphasis here in these first two verses is on Sarah. You know, her name is repeated four times in these two verses. She's the only woman in the Bible whose age is recorded at the time of their death. Okay, so Sarah, really a key figure in God's plan. Sarah is upheld in the New Testament as a model of a godly woman. You know, in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 3 through 6, she's upheld as a model of godliness for a woman to follow. Is Mary upheld anywhere in the New Testament? No. But Sarah is upheld. You know, if anybody should be the co-redemptrix, it should probably be Sarah, not Mary. But Sarah is, again, just a model of godliness. We know Sarah wasn't perfect, okay? So that's always an encouragement. Sarah was a woman of God, a model to follow, but she wasn't perfect. But we learn from her mistakes, just like we learn from her godliness as well. It's also, too, interesting that Sarah's honored. There's only two women honored in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 11, and one of those is Sarah, and the other one is Rahab. So, again, just the prominence of Sarah in the Scripture, in the storyline of the Gospel. And they live in Kiriath Arba, so an earlier name for Hebron. Literally, it means city of four. And the idea of most commentators think there's probably four kind of smaller cities sort of close together. And so kind of all of them would be Kiriath Arba, and Hebron would be part of that. So it's all in the vicinity of Hebron. And then I like, you know, Abraham here has genuine, understandable sorrow after the death of his wife. You know, he mourns and he weeps. And I believe that's the first use of the word weep in the Old Testament. But again, it's not despair, but genuine, real sorrow at the loss of a partner. You think about the things they've been through together for 62 years since they came to Canaan, you know, in Egypt and in Palestine, you know, in the Philistine area, and just all the things they've gone through. I always wonder if Abraham ever told Sarah about the sacrifice thing, or if he kind of just left that under the radar. But again, he's sorrowful. You know, understandably sorrowful over the death of his beloved wife. And then, you know, that made me think of 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 13. You know, we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve as those who have no hope. You know, what did Jesus do when Lazarus died? Jesus wept. You know, Jesus knew that he was going to resurrect him just pretty much immediately after that. But Jesus wept because of the sorrow and pain of separation from death. And that's true. And sorrow is natural and good. But then when the sorrow kind of goes down into the issue of despair and grief, that's where it gets a little out of kilter. But again, Abraham is sorrowful, and there's nothing wrong with that. He's weeping for his wife. And then in verse 3, and Abraham rose from before his dead wife, and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a sojourner and a foreign resident among you. Give me a possession for a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. So, verse 5. And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, "Hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial sites. None of us will refuse you his burial sites for burying your dead." So again, Abraham now wants to secure a place to bury Sarah. And so he negotiates with these sons of Heth. Now, term sons of Heth, it's literally sons of Heth. I believe that's how New American Standard has it. Some translations translated Hittites, and that's not technically what is stated there. We're going to talk about the Hittites in a little while, though. But Heth, sons of Heth, Heth is listed in Genesis chapter 10, verse 15, in the Table of Nations, as a son of Canaan, the son of Ham. And so that he would be a local to that area. So this would be a Canaanite clan that descended from Heth in that general area. And then in verse 10, it does call Ephron, calls Ephron the Hittite. And there we're literally talking about Hittites. So we don't want to get the sons of Heth, probably different from the Hittites that we see in verse 10. And then while we're talking about Hittites, I'll just go ahead and mention, again, the Hittites are first mentioned back in Genesis chapter 15, verse 20, as one of the 10 Canaanite peoples living in the area promised to Abraham. So if we go back there, it's listing all of these, you know, you're going to possess this and this and this and the Hittites. And then that gives a lot of people heart attacks, because the Hittites were an ancient empire that was very mighty and powerful and centered up in Turkey in Asia Minor, 300 miles to the north of Canaan. So how could there be Hittites up there and Hittites down there? You know, and then I was thinking, we have Indians in India and we have Indians in North America. How did that happen? You know, just because names are the same doesn't necessarily mean that there's a connection. I mean, Indians, we're now Native Americans, but, you know, there's no connection between the Indians of India and the Indians of North America. And so that could be the type of thing where there's just no connection between the Hittites that are in Canaan and the Hittites that are up in Turkey. Or it may be that there's some genetic connection behind the scenes, or maybe they share the same language. But, a lot of critics will say, aha, they said there's Hittites down here before the Hittite Empire was even started, and this can't be, the Bible's wrong. No, there's easy explanations, a number of scenarios to explain why we're talking about Hittites in Canaan, when the world-known mighty Hittite Empire was centered up north further. So, verse 4. Abraham explains the situation. I'm a sojourner and a foreigner, resident among you, again, talking to the sons of Heth. Give me a possession for a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. So again, the key here is he wants to bury Sarah. He's not going to go back to Haran or back to Ur, to his homeland. He wants to bury her in Canaan. You know, he now thought of Canaan as his native land. Again, his faith in the promises of God. How much land does he own in Canaan? None. But based on the promises of God, that's what he considers now to be his home. So he begins negotiations, and that's kind of what we have unfolding through Genesis chapter 24. It's kind of this bartering process, these negotiations going on. And he starts by stating his social status. He's a sojourner and a foreign resident. And it's interesting that all five translations that I use for studying all translate this just a little different. So sojourner and foreign resident is stranger and sojourner in NASB, sojourner and foreigner in ESV, foreigner and a visitor in New King James, foreigner and a stranger in NIV, foreign resident and a temporary settler in the New English Translation. So it's all just a little bit different how it's translated. But the key idea, you don't want to get it lost, the key idea is he's not native to the land. Okay, that's not where he was originally from. And we know from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 9, that he lived as a sojourner throughout his entire life in Canaan. In fact, the only place that he's ever going to own is the burial site that he's negotiating for right now to bury his wife, Sarah. So he says, and then in verse 4, it says, you know, I'm a sojourner and a foreigner resident among you. Give me a possession. He's not saying I want it for free. The idea here is I want to change some ownership. I want a title to this is the idea there. So you know, sell me some property, I think is how NIV puts it. So, and again, he clarifies, this isn't, it's, he's not a threat to these people. He's not looking for a homestead. He's looking for a place to bury his wife, is what he's looking for. And he clarifies all that for them. And then in verse 5, you know, his reputation, the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, "Hear us, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial sites. None of us will refuse you this burial site for burying your dead." So again, he's got a reputation. You know, they call him a mighty prince. That word mighty is Elohim. It's literally God. I think some of the translations have it, prince of God is what it literally is. He's recognized as a special recipient of divine favor. You know, Abimelech back in chapter 21, you know, said, God is with you in all you do. Again, this was Abraham's reputation was spread across the area. Everybody knew that he had a special relationship with God. You know, special relationship with God would be manifest in his wealth. You know, he's not native to the land, doesn't own any land, but look at his herds. Look at the size of his servants. You know, look at the size of his household. Remember back in the day when he chased all those kings from the east, you know, back in chapter 14. Remember back in the day he chased all those kings from the east clear back to, you know, Mesopotamia. And so he had a reputation. And they acknowledge that. And he's not perceived as a threat. And his presence by the sons of Heth is universally welcomed. You know, and they exceed his request. You know, you can have the choicest of tombs, you know, and an assurance that no one will refuse you when you ask this because of your reputation. Okay, verse 7. So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, "If it is your desire for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and meet with Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me, that he may give the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him, which is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as a possession for a burial site." So again, Abraham, you know, bowing in humility to the people. This is the only time mentioned where Abraham bows before inhabitants of Canaan. His other bowing is to God. But here he bows down and he tells him, "Hey, I've got a site. Now that you mention it, you know, you said you're going to help me out here. I do have a site in mind." We don't particularly know why this was the site he had in mind, but it's belonged to Ephron. And Ephron was the son of Zohar. And again, we don't know anything else about Ephron or Zohar outside of this passage in Genesis. So he requests that the sons of Heth intercede on his behalf with Ephron. And he wants to pay the full price. He wants things to be above board, you know, all, you know, no questions. Let's do this right. Do it the right way. Follow the right process. He doesn't want any questions or future squabbles like he had back in Beersheba in chapter 21 over the well rights. Okay, he wants it to be just very clear that he owns this site, and that's where he's burying his wife. Okay, now we're going to go down to some negotiations with Ephron. And verse 10, now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even of all who went in at the gate of the city, saying, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead." So this delegation of sons of Heth go with Abraham. You know, was this the same city they were in, or did they go to a new city that was Ephron's city? We don't really know for sure. We don't want to get lost in some of those inconsequential details. But the key idea here is that the sons of Heth are with Abraham when he talks to Ephron. Okay, and they're kind of relaying to Ephron what the proposal is. So they're at the city gate. That's where business and civil transactions were conducted. There's apparently a sizable crowd there. And then in verse 11, you know, he says, "I give it to you." That's either a remarkable act of gratuity or a bargaining ploy. You know, it's like, "Oh, I'll give it to you." And Abraham's going to go, "No, that's not where we start." And the idea there is more, it's going to be, probably means more here to sell. You know, start the bartering process. "Yeah, I'll give this to you. Yeah, this can be yours." And then kind of go from there with the bartering. And it's interesting that Ephron in verse 11 is not just the cave, but he wants to include the field. And there's a lot of commentary written on, well, why did he want to include the field and the cave? And there's maybe some legal things that were beneficial, tax incentives or something like that. But in the Hittite law, there's might have been beneficial to Ephron to sell the whole unit of land rather than just the cave. So, but anyway, the cave is included in the bartering here. So then verse 12, and Abraham bowed before the people of the land, so again showing his humility, and he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, if you will only please hear me, I will give the silver for the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead, there. Then Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, my Lord, hear me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between me and you? So bury your dead. So Abraham, you know, again demonstrates his respect. He bows down. And then he proposes, you know, a fair purchase price. He wants to ensure that he has ownership, you know, legal ownership of the land. And in verse 15, Ephron states that the land is worth 400 shekels of silver. And there's general agreement that 400 shekels of silver was a huge amount for this piece of land. You kind of think of the bartering. If you're going to barter with somebody over something, what's the first price you give? It's not low, it's high. And that's kind of the idea here. And there's some ancient Near Eastern records that would indicate that this was probably an extremely high amount for this kind of a field and a cave. So, we don't know for sure, but that's kind of the idea. And again, part of the bartering process. And in verse 15, you're kind of like that, what is that between you and me? You know, you can kind of hear that bartering. Yeah, but that's no big deal, you know. Let's go ahead. We'll have this great relationship. Go ahead and pay me the 400 shekels of silver. And then Abraham, he's willing to pay it, you know, without bartering. Probably, he accepts the asking price. And probably a reflection of his wealth. He's a man of great wealth. And he wants to get things done. You know, his wife is there and needs to be buried. And he wants to get this done. And besides, he knows, hey, someday I'm going to have all this anyway. So, his faith in God's promises of the land, that he would possess the land of Canaan. So, verse 16. So Abraham heard Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. So the negotiations conclude. There's a formal purchase agreement and a financial transaction, and then silver was used, and it was commercial standard. And that means it was the standard of the day. It wasn't any funny money or anything. It was the commercial standard of the day. And it's one of those things where, other than NASB, all the other translations translate that commercial standard just a little different. So it's according to the weights current among the merchants in ESV and NIV. It's a currency of the merchants in King James, according to the standard of measurement of the time in the New English translation. I think that captures it real well. That was the standard of the day. Again, this was all above board, nothing underhanded. Abraham wanted to make sure this was all legally proper, that he owned this land. And so he weighs out the silver. Okay, verse 17. So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and the cave, which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field that were within all the confines of its border were deeded over to Abraham as purchased in the sight of the sons of Heth before all who came in at the city gate. So again, the city gates where all the business transactions were done, and Abraham got what he wanted. Okay, he has this permanent, uncontested title to this land, secured by a formal witness transaction at a more than fair price, and again, many witnesses. So it's clear that Abraham owns this land. It becomes his rightful possession. There's going to be no future change of mind by the seller. It's all done legally. And again, his ownership is confirmed without dispute. Verse 19. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field at Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a possession, for a burial site by the sons of Heth. So again, Sarah now is laid to rest. And I think it's important to note this is kind of a chapter of transition. You know, the generation of Abraham and Sarah is passing off the scene. And the very end of chapter 22 kind of put us into this mode. We're talking now about Rebekah. We're going to move from the generation of Abraham and Sarah now to the generation of Isaac and Rebekah. And Machpelah, the cave there, becomes the future burial site of Abraham, as well as Isaac and Rebekah and Leah and Jacob. So it's going to be a kind of the family mausoleum area. The only one who's not going to be buried there is Rachel, and we'll talk about that when we get to chapter 35. And again, this is the only actual land possession in Canaan that Abraham ever has. Okay, it's the beginning of the fulfillment of the land promise, but far from the end. Okay, Joshua's going to take over a lot of the land, and the kings are going to expand it, and it's going to contract. But of course, the fulfillment of the land promise awaits the future reign of Christ, when Israel will have, the Jews will have, all of the land promised originally to Abraham. And again, I think emphasizing the fact that Abraham burying Sarah in Canaan is proof of his unwavering faith. You know, God said, this will be your land, and he believes that. So he buries his wife there. That's their new ancestral burial ground. So, and then verse 20, the chapter kind of concludes with a brief summary of their agreement just made. It's kind of interesting that we get insight into this bartering process of the ancient Near East. And, you know, why would God want to go through all these details? They're all important. It's like almost like a genealogy where you can kind of read through it fast and sort of go, ah, that was not much there. There's a lot there about what's going on. I mean, Abraham, his faith is being manifest. His love for his wife is being manifest. God's faithfulness to his promises is being manifest. So we want to pick up on all those things and keep those in mind as we work through details like this. So we'll go ahead and stop there. Next week, chapter 24, Isaac marries Rebekah. And it's the longest chapter in Genesis, so a lot of narrative there. So does anybody have any questions or thoughts, any observations? Any corrections? I appreciate those too. Yeah, Jack. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not quite, does anybody have any knowledge on current archaeology? I mean, most of these sites are so ancient now that there's question as to whether they actually find anything or not. But I'm not sure. If who's been to Israel? Yeah, but is the cave at Machpelah, is that a site that's been identified?
At Hebron or Hebron, yeah. I think there is a for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but I think the Muslims control it, so
you don't get to see it.
But they kind of know where it's at, I think, that's where they died and were buried.
So the general site is maybe not the exact plot of ground, but the general area. Okay, yeah, very cool. I hope that, when we get to heaven and we have the Bible 101 class, I hope we have an archaeology 101 class too, and we get to go see where everything was at for sure. And he laughs at us, yeah, they thought Machpelah was there. It was really here. So anything else? Good question. I like that. Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and close in prayer. Dear Father, again, we want to just praise you and thank you for this day, for this time together, to just fellowship around your word, to honor and glorify you through studying your word. And just thank you, Father, for the work you do in our lives as we come to understand it better. We thank you for your spirit who helps us understand your word better. We just want, Father, we just want you to know, Father, that our goal in studying your word and serving you is to become more and more like Jesus. We just ask you, Father, to take our hearts, take our minds, take our actions, and make them all pleasing to you, controlled by you, so that we can glorify you and worship you in a way that's pleasing to you. We just pray, Father, for the sermon to follow. We just ask, Father, again, that you'd use your word to build us up in our faith and to mature us in our faith. In Jesus' name, amen.